Welcome to the NorCal Real Estate Show, where we're talking all things real estate in Yolo, Sacramento, and Solano counties. My name is Jeremy Higgins. I'm the founder of the Higgins team at EXP, and we are here with
Andrew
Lujewski, otherwise known as Drewski. One of these times, I'm just going to say Drewski, right? Like, I think I've said otherwise known as probably five times.
I need to do like a legal name change.
You should, because it does not Google very well.
It does not roll off the tongue. It's pretty brutal.
Yeah, but Andrew, my man, and then we're also here with the incredible Nate Darling, our producer of Darling New Media Studios here in Sacramento, California. How you doing, Nate?
I'm doing great, gentlemen. Thanks for another episode. Excited to find out things from the buyer's perspective
today. That's right. That's right. We talked about the seller's perspective as it relates to an escrow and what happens in an escrow. And it's kind of a longer series, so we decided to break it up into a two-part series. We are wearing the same clothes because it's actually the same day. Probably shouldn't have brought that up, but I did.
We're normal people.
Before we get into the second part of in escrow now and oh shit, now what? We're gonna talk about the tip of the day. What do you got?
Tip of the day. If you're looking to purchase a home, first step is to get pre-qualified. But my tip of the day is to take that a step further and get what's called fully underwritten by your lender. So normally in a pre-qualification, lenders are really overzealous and they want to give you this really high number to get you to go shopping and make everyone happy. And they look at, you know, your income and credit score. I make $50,000 a year. My credit score is probably like a 720 or something, right? Real general. Here's your pre-approval letter for $500,000. Go shopping. Well, a lot of problems can come up in financing when you're in escrow, right? So to take it one step further, you can get fully underwritten by your lender before you go shopping. And they're going to look at your employment, your credit history. They're going to verify your income, bank statements, the whole deal. They're going to look at your debt to income ratio, see, you know, car payments, this and that. And they're going to give you what's called a fully underwritten pre-approval. And that basically means you are an appraisal and a purchase contract away from getting your loan approved. And that can save you a ton of headache down the road, because just last week I had a guy that had a regular pre-qualification. Everything looked great. Income looked good. Credit score looked good. But when we jumped into it and it came down to the financing and getting the loan approved, we found out that we could only use 1 year of his business tax returns because of how he did his taxes. And that disqualified him for a bunch of different loan packages. And if we would have gotten him fully underwritten ahead of time, we wouldn't have had that issue.
I think it ties in really well to our topic of the day too, as well as far as escrows and the amount of things that have to happen during an escrow period. There's a lot of stuff that's going to happen during
escrow. A lot of moving parts.
There's a lot of moving parts. You're going to be doing your inspections. You're going to be doing negotiations and all that kind of stuff. And when you just add in all of the lending side of things as well, it can get really, really overwhelming. So it may be we believe it is better for you to go ahead and jump through all those lending hoops up front when the pressure's not on, the timing, the pressure of timing is not there. Mm-hmm. Just go through it at your pace. And then when you're ready, we can jump into the actual purchase of your house and the escrow process, and half the stuff is already done. So I think that's a great segue into the buyer process as it relates to the escrow. So we went through all the seller stuff, which was what we got inspections, the buyer's inspections. We have, what were some of the other things that we talked about there?
Appraisal negotiation.
The appraisal, disclosures. That was a big one, right? Mm-hmm. Getting your disclosures done up front. So in many ways, the buyer side is opposite, but it does come from a different perspective. We are coming from a different perspective, so it is going to be a little bit different. So first thing that happens when you are in escrow, you get the phone call from your real estate agent. You say, congratulations, your offer is accepted. That is the time when the anxiety kicks in.
Through the roof.
We've been through it ourselves. We're pretty experienced at the selling the real estate stuff, but when it's your own personal house, it can get pretty crazy. So those are that's when the sleepless nights are going to start and all that kind of stuff. And as we said in the previous episode, the more you know about what's going to happen in the future, the more ease it is going to bring you. So the first thing that's going to happen is you're going to get your purchase agreement over to your lender, and your real estate agent should be doing that for you, right? Like a lot.
Yeah. So what we try to do when we open escrow, we send out this really great opening email, and we get to tie in the lender, the title officer. We get to incorporate all of these moving parts and get everyone all connected at one time. And that way everyone knows what's going on.
That's probably one of the greatest things that we ever came up with in the process of selling a home, is just email and text messaging, getting everybody onto the same email thread, the same text thread, and you just roll with it. So oftentimes we get to the end of a deal and we'll have one email that's just been reply all to, 50 times.
Well, everyone needs to be on the same page, right? We have this executed contract between the buyer and the seller. Well, the buyer's lender needs to have that contract, so they know the purchase price, they know the timelines that we're working with. And then the title company needs to have that contract so they can know what our timelines are. Everyone needs to stick to their contractual timelines. You know, they're the neutral third party there.
Yeah. And so we mentioned the first thing you do is get that purchase agreement over to the lender. Mm-hmm. We mean that.
Day zero.
There's no doubt that if there is a delay in escrow, 9.5 out of 10 times that delay is going to come from the lending side of things. And this is not necessarily on the lender, by the way. Oftentimes it's on you. So what I'm going to say is, when it comes to priorities in a transaction, your lender should always get the priority. If Andrew and I are reaching out to you saying, hey, we want to schedule an appointment to review disclosures, and your lender is saying they need something from you, your lender gets the priority. I can't explain all the back ends of lending. Maybe we'll have a lender on here one day that we can talk about that. But all I know is that your delay of one day can cause a 4-day delay in the process.
Right. And that perfectly ties into our tip of the day, which is get fully underwritten, right? That means your lender is going to have all those documents all ready to go, so that when you're in contract, you have the accepted offer, that lender doesn't need anything from you. He gets the contract from us, the appraisal gets ordered, and they're crunching away and they're way ahead of schedule.
One of the first things the lender is going to ask for after the purchase contract is that escrow information. So kind of simultaneously, we do it simultaneously, but pretty much simultaneously, we're going to be opening up escrow. We did discuss a little bit about what escrow is in the previous episode. So if you want to know more about that, you just got to go back to the previous episode and we'll tell you all about it. But the escrow company is going to work very closely with that lender to get the lender all the information they need. The lender does need the title report and all that kind of stuff. And then the escrow company helps the lender with a lot of the numbers, what taxes are going to be, what utilities are going to be, all that kind of stuff.
Those are all factored into your closing costs.
Yep.
So once we get the opening email out, lender gets the contract, title gets the contract, the next step is going to be for the buyer to get their earnest money deposit in. They have 3 days after the accepted offer to do that.
What is an earnest money deposit? What does it mean to a buyer? What does it mean to a seller?
Well, to a seller, that's the buyer's skin in the game. That if a buyer decides to go all the way up to the finish line almost, remove all their contingencies, and then cancel, that seller has the right to keep that buyer's deposit. And for a buyer, this is your commitment to stick with the purchase, because if a buyer goes into a purchase and they decide to back out, that could potentially lose a lot of money for the seller, right? And that's kind of your penalty for that.
Yeah, 100%. So the earnest money is something that everyone watches very closely. Although that earnest money in many instances is going to be refundable for the beginning portions of the escrow, because you're more than likely going to have some contingency periods in there that allows you an opportunity to go in there and inspect the house, get an appraisal on the house and make sure that the house is going to appraise where you need it to and all that kind of stuff. If something goes sideways and you as a buyer decide to cancel the agreement and you're doing that contractually, then that money will ultimately come back to you or should come back to you. And that is another really important component of the escrow company. The escrow company is a neutral third party in this transaction. So they're not necessarily representing you and they're not representing the other party. So that money goes to this neutral third party, and then that third party will not release that money to anyone else until they have an agreement from both parties on where that money needs to go. So if you and if the buyer ends up canceling the contract and the seller believes that they're doing that outside of the legal contractual right, then that seller would object to the money being returned. Mm-hmm. And the escrow company would simply hold on to that money until the buyer and seller, litigate or whatever they're going to do, mediation. Probably. I don't think we've ever really been involved in litigation, but mediation until the buyer and seller come to an agreement. So that money is going to be secure. So whether you're the buyer or the seller, you can feel comfortable that that money is going to be secure. It's not going to be released to the other party without your agreement or at least some sort of, court order or something like that.
Yeah. And your earnest money deposit that gets rolled into your down payment later on as a buyer. So, it's part of your down payment, but with the EMD, you have three ways you can, submit your EMD. You can drop off a check, you can wire the money, or you can drop off
cashier's check, kind of the same thing, or a bag of pennies,
or some cash if you want.
Did you hear that story the other day? The gentleman who paid his last child support payment in pennies, and they
have to accept it though, right? It is U.S. currency.
What a jack! You know what?
I'm not going to get into the details here.
He literally drove up with a truck and dropped a load of pennies on the driveway.
Not a classy move.
And no.
Something similar happened, I want to say about 8-9 months ago. Someone did a final paycheck for their employee and did it that way, except they soaked them in oil and dumped them in his driveway.
What an ass.
So the news story had this guy cleaning pennies in a wheelbarrow in his garage that was his last paycheck. Yes, it is legal tender, but...
It's brutal.
Yeah. So just because something is legal doesn't mean it's okay.
Correct. So earnest money deposit, personal check is fine, or more times than not, it's going to be a wire to the bank. And I think, we would be doing a disservice if we didn't talk about wire transfer fraud, all that kind of stuff. I think that's a really important thing. It's not something that's like super sexy and exciting, but it is the real deal. Never has happened to us personally, but I know my father's also in real estate, and it did happen to him one time. Fortunately, no money was lost, but there is a lot of wire fraud going out there. And one of the popular ways that they're doing it here in our area, at least, is somehow folks get in touch with the idea that you're in escrow, and it's usually through your agent's email, I think. And anyway, my dad's client received, I probably shouldn't even say that. Hopefully my dad doesn't listen to this. He's like, why are you throwing me under the bus? Anyway, somebody's client received an email from their agent, and they acted as if they were the agent and asked them to submit their earnest money deposit to this wiring location. Now, fortunately, my dad had done a good job up front in preparing their client and said, look, as a real estate agent, I have no use for any of your financial information. I'm never going to need your social security number. I'm never going to need your routing numbers, any of your bank account information or anything like that. So if you receive any phone calls from anybody, acting as if they're representing me, or any emails acting as if they're representing me, asking you for that information, that is a 100% red flag, and you need to give me a call right away. So fortunately, nothing was lost in that instance, but it does happen. It happens quite regularly. Most title companies now have warnings. I think we have a warning in our purchase agreement about mm-hmm. it. So here's the deal. When you get into escrow, your real estate agent's going to reach out to you, and they're going to let you know who your escrow officer is, what the escrow number is, what their contact information is. You are eventually going to receive an email from your title company requesting information. That title company is going to need more sensitive information. They're going to need your bank account information. They're going to need your social security and all that kind of stuff. But you want to verify that the email that you're receiving requesting that information is from, in fact, from the escrow company. So the best way to go about that is you pull up your email from your agent and you say, okay, the title company is XYZ. Their phone number is this. You pick up the phone and you say, hey, Mr. or Mrs. Escrow Officer, did you just send me an email requesting this information? They say, yes, I did. And now you know you're good. And you can go ahead and do that. For those who are a little bit more cautious, just ride your bike down there and drop a check off.
There you go.
Good deal.
So EMD submitted within the first 3 days. Next step in the process is going to be, as a buyer, order your core five inspections.
At least
core five. Sometimes you have a swimming pool or a spa, you need to order additional inspections, a chimney, whatever it might be.
Absolutely. The core five, we talked about it a million times, so we're not going to belabor that here, but the core five, you're going to order those. And then oftentimes there'll be something that comes up in one of those inspection reports that might recommend that you get further inspection. And at that time you can get maybe you can get an electrician, for instance. If the home inspector says something looks a little janky here with your electricity, we're not sure what's going on. Andrew, we were just conversing about the basement what beam that was cut off or something like that. Mm-hmm. So in a situation like that, you might want to get a structural engineer in there and give you an idea of whether or not that that beam actually is important.
Is important or not, yeah.
I think it was, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was a friend of mine that just recently purchased a house.
With another agent,
which he described a situation. He had three other realtor friends. He didn't want to hurt anyone's feelings, so he picked a random person. Well,
Don't do that. Just call us.
Just give us a call. But he was showing me his beautiful house that he just bought. And he's like, oh, check out my basement. And we went and saw the basement, which is right underneath the kitchen. And I saw this beam that was supporting the kitchen floor, and it just stops halfway through the kitchen floor. And I was just kind of looking at it like, there's no way. And I went and I grabbed the beam, and you could literally move the beam. And I was like, I don't want to say his name, but I was like, hey, remember that bow in the floor I was talking about a second ago when we were in your kitchen? This is why. And he's like, my agent said it wasn't a big deal because there was stuff in the basement and we couldn't get the inspector in. And I was like, that is the fault of your agent. You do not move forward until you get your full inspection done and completed.
The beam's not a big deal.
No.
The beam is not a big deal.
Nate, come on, dude. Like, there's like 50 beams going through the house. What does one matter?
All right. The beams.
All beams matter.
Dude, it's like a game of Jenga, folks. So like, you pull one beam out and it absolutely has a chain effect. So I think that little story there segues right into the next one, which is the inspections, deciding which, well, not segue into the next one. It continues on what we were talking about, but which inspections you want, and then making sure that they're done thoroughly and that you're having some pretty good conversation with your real estate agent, the inspector themselves, about what all of these things mean. And everybody's experience level is different. So you're just going to have to kind of get a feel for the folks that you're talking to. Do you feel like they understand what's going on? Obviously, in this case that Andrew was talking about, the beam was not accessible at the time of the inspection. I guarantee you that the home inspector made note of that somewhere. Oh, yeah. That said that they weren't able to gain access to it. So in that instance, no doubt we would have, our request for repair would have had something to do with clear that area out so we can inspect it. I think that's a pretty important thing. That's also very common with pest inspections. Garages tend to be full of stuff. And so pest inspectors can't get to the edges of the walls. And, I'd say over half of all termite situations that I've ever encountered have all been in the garage. So I think it's a pretty important thing to inspect. So just don't let things slide. I think that's one of the things in this market, with it's being so competitive, buyers feel like they don't really have any options. And I'm just telling you that once you're in escrow, you have a lot more leverage than you think you do. And I think you should take advantage of it and do a thorough inspection. I remember back in the REO days, the foreclosure days, I guess, for the layman person. But it was widely known that the banks would not agree to do any repairs on a transaction. And so there were clients being told by their agents that they shouldn't get inspections because there's no way that that you're going to get the bank to repair them. That is like, that could not be more wrong. I don't care if you've negotiated with the seller that you're not going to request any repairs. That's a pretty common thing to do in a market like this in order to remain competitive. But that does not mean that you don't go in there and still inspect these homes and make sure that they're up to par. I mean, you go in there and you find out that there's a $100,000 foundation problem. You might have agreed that you're not going to request for repairs, but you're certainly going to cancel that escrow.
Good chance to walk away.
Yeah. Or just reopen negotiations, I guess.
There you go. So yeah, that brings us into the next step, right? You go and you get all of your inspections done. You get your reports back. We're reviewing them with you. We'll give some guidance on what we think is important. And then we'll ask you what you think is important. You know, if cosmetic stuff is important to you and you want some siding replaced, whatever it is, we can ask for that. But the next step is going to be negotiating again, right? We're going to have to submit a request for repairs, reach out to the seller. Hey, we want X, Y, and Z done. You know, what's the deal?
Have you ever heard of us talk about the core five and the importance of getting the core five?
I think I've heard it a couple times now.
So this is another example. If we had the core five in play, then these negotiations would be rather simple. But we're talking about the buyer side. So we're going to be talking about us working with buyers and what we typically run into when we're working with our buyers, because our buyers are generally going to be writing offers on other agents' listings. And therefore, the other listings aren't typically going to have the core five, which then requires us to assist our clients in getting those core five and any other inspections. But it all comes down to leverage during these negotiations. And at the beginning, when you were initially writing your offer on this property and you were potentially competing with 5, 10, 15 people, you didn't have a whole lot of leverage. If you went in there at that point and said, hey, I want you to replace your water heater that's faulty. I want you to fix your $1,500 worth of roof repairs and your $800 worth of HVAC repairs. The seller would say, pound sand. I'll go pick one of these other 15 buyers that I have, right? Mm-hmm. But this isn't that, because in your instance, more than likely, you're going to be writing an offer on a house that did not have those core five. Unless you're buying one of our listings, then sorry, you're out of luck. But you're going to be entering into a negotiation where those core five weren't done. And therefore, you are going to have leverage because you're going to go in there and you're going to do those inspections. And then you have the opportunity to negotiate with the seller to make these repairs. And the seller has to decide. Like, are they going to say no and potentially risk that you walk and then they have to go back onto the market again and with that big black eye that they have and all that kind of stuff, right? So really take advantage of this situation. What are some common things, or what are some common expectations that a buyer might have on what type of things a seller's going to tend to agree to, or what kind of things do you think is appropriate in a request for repair?
So in the case of, you know, say a house has a bad roof, the roof is completely shot. I think it can be a reasonable request, right? You go and you pay full price for a house. I think it's totally reasonable for a seller to provide a functional roof with a decent life expectancy, right? What I would consider frivolous or not reasonable would be really small minor things like, oh, the chandelier has a piece missing on it, or this light bulb's out, or whatever it might be. Big core items, pest work, you know, dry rot, stuff like that, I think is totally reasonable. Small stuff, not so reasonable.
So I'm going to ask all real estate agents who are listening to turn your podcast off right now or fast forward through the next few minutes, because I don't want you to hear this. But I think what I've witnessed throughout my years is that there tends to be a little bit of friction between a buyer and their agent at this point, where the buyer wants to request X, Y, and Z.
Everything under the moon.
And the real estate agent is trying to, you know, carefully tiptoe around it and try to get the buyer to kind of back off of their request. Mm-hmm. And there's no doubt that there are certain instances in your negotiation where you may not be helping yourself by nitpicking and asking for unreasonable things. Because I think what happens in those types of situations is sellers start making decisions based off of emotion rather than reality or what's best for them, what's best for the transaction. And so you do want to be careful about being too nitpicky with stuff. With that being said, going back to your negotiation, you have the leverage at this point. And so if it's important to you, I believe that it's important for us to at least work to get you what you want. I think we owe you that right. And I think you have that right as a buyer. So I would say do not ever hesitate to ask for something that is important to you. We have folks that we work with who are very comfortable with, you know, maybe some sort of, you know, maybe they're comfortable with electrical, right? And so we run into a situation where there's a panel that has a couple of missing breakers or loose breakers or whatever. And they're like, yeah, no big deal. I could fix that for a couple of bucks. No problem. But look, if that were my house, I don't want to be anywhere near electricity. Mm-hmm. I am not messing with that thing. So I'm not going to burn my house down or do any of that kind of stuff. So in that instance, I would absolutely be requesting that somebody come out and fix the electrical, right? So it's not the same for everybody. If you're comfortable with certain aspects of repairing certain things in your house, then by all means, don't burn the leverage that you are. Don't burn, I don't know how I want to say it, but like, you're only going to get so much from a seller. So like, use it wisely and don't use it on something that you're comfortable taking care of yourself. Save it for the things that are important to you.
Yeah. I've had buyers that want every little single thing fixed on the house, which, you know, that's totally fine. I understand. Right. But from a seller looking at that request for repairs, it has a million things on it. Sometimes it's so over the top where the seller's like, I'm not doing anything. You guys are asking for way too much. So there's a really fine line of getting really important stuff done and maybe leaving the more cosmetic, frivolous stuff, you know, for a later date.
I would agree. I think I'm a fan of siding on the side of take advantage of the position that you're in and the leverage that you have. And don't let anyone talk you out of doing that. So, but there is no doubt that you can overdo it and then sellers are going to start making decisions based off emotion. And once that happens, then you're done. So you gotta play that balance pretty good.
So that's negotiating repairs, huge aspect to any real estate transaction, right? During this time, your lender is having an appraiser sent out to your house. Your lender will only lend you the amount that the house appraises for, no more. Okay. So with that, you have three things that can happen. They send the appraiser out, the house appraises for less than what you offered, which is what you don't want, because you're going to have to bridge that gap, cash out of pocket. What you can hope for, fingers crossed, you get a full price appraisal. Everyone's happy, seller's happy, you're happy. And in some cases, I've come across it a couple of times in the last few months where the appraisal actually comes in higher than the purchase price.
You're a big winner in that situation.
Big winner.
And don't tell your seller if that's happened.
Well, what you can do as a buyer is you can ask the seller potentially for a credit back. You can bring that purchase price up $5,000 or $10,000 and you can ask for that credit back so that you have cash in pocket to put towards repairs or closing costs, whatever it is, or another project that you have in mind.
Yeah. So the appraisal is something that we're dealing with a lot these days because it feels like the appraisals are coming in low on a lot of deals just because buyers are riding so high just to get these houses. So that's something that you really want to kind of decide on in advance. That's not something that you want to be surprised with, right? So you should have a discussion with your real estate agent ahead of time. What do you think this house is realistically going to appraise for? Keep in mind that none of us, real estate agents, appraisers, anybody's really going to be able to predict what that appraisal is absolutely going to come in at because appraisers are human. I've had a transaction in the past. It was Rio Linda, so it was kind of a unique property. We had two separate appraisers with two separate banks that did the appraisal within, I think, a 21-day period of time, and they were $100,000 difference. So one was like $559,000 and the other one was $459,000, if I remember correctly. It's a huge difference. So you can't always predict what that the appraisal is going to come in at, but you should have a general idea of what the appraisal is going to come in at. And I think you should be prepared on how you're going to handle that. You have three options. You either come in with the difference yourself, you negotiate with the seller to get them to bring it down, or you do kind of a tweener hybrid negotiation where the seller brings it down a little bit and you bring some extra cash in. But if you haven't really discussed that in advance, you're going to be in a tough spot to be able to negotiate that in the middle of the deal.
Yeah. It's, at the end of the day, an appraisal is an opinion of value, an opinion, right? It's not a fact. It's someone's opinion. And, we can see huge swings, huge variations from appraiser to appraiser. Obviously, generally, for a buyer, you want that appraisal to come in at full price, but that's not always the case. So when you're writing a good offer as a buyer, sometimes you need to get sort of a median value for a neighborhood and get kind of a projection on where you think it might appraise, and then take that and look at your offering price. And part of writing a good offer in this market is covering an appraisal shortage. Sometimes it's like, hey, we think this is probably going to appraise at about 450, but we're going to offer 480. And as a buyer, you need to be able to come up with that difference, you know, in cash, $30,000. And what I've seen with some more inexperienced agents, there was a house in Citrus Heights a couple months ago that got over 100 offers, right? Those listed around $400,000. I think someone offered, $550,000 on it. $150,000 over. And those people are probably left thinking, why didn't we get the house? Well, an experienced listing agent's looking at, you know, you guys don't have that much money in the bank and there's no way you can cover an appraisal gap of $130,000.
Yeah. My listing's worth $400,000. It's not worth $550. We're never going to get an appraisal.
Your bank is only going to loan you what the house appraises for.
Yeah. It's just smoke and mirrors, really. Yeah.
There you go.
So that's the appraisal. We could go on and on about negotiations, and maybe we'll have an episode about negotiations in the future, and different things that you can do. But, I guess I'll just kind of leave it at this with the appraisal. Try not to like talk to everybody about what the appraisal is, 'cause you don't really know how you're going to leverage yourself until you're in the moment. And, I think a lot of people have loose lips and they want to talk. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of unrelated, but we just ran into a situation, a while back where, you know, houses were selling for crazy amounts of money and they were getting lots of offers, and we come across the house and, we were expecting multiple offers on it. The buyer was ready to offer about, I think it was $110,000 over the list price in order to remain competitive. And in fact, we had the offer written up and in hand, and the other agent reached out and said, hey, are you bringing us an offer? Because if you are, you might be the only one. And I was like, say what? And so I went back to my buyers immediately and I said, hey, like, there's no sense in you offering $110,000 over list price when you're not competing with anybody. But the other thing that happens in that transaction is, you know, maybe you thought you had to put an appraisal shortage of $30,000 in there. Well, if you're not competing with anybody, then you don't necessarily have to do that. Like, keep the appraisal contingency in there. Leave yourself an opportunity to negotiate a low appraisal in the future. So those are really important things to do. So just keep things, you know, tight to your chest throughout the transaction. There's a reason for doing that. It's a very exciting time. You want to talk to everybody about what you're doing, but just keep things tight to your chest.
Yes.
So the real answer is, if you really want to talk to somebody about something, talk to your realtor about it.
Yeah, your realtor therapist.
Yeah, and just keep it at that, because you're working together on getting this thing done, and talking to your pal is giving you a chance to blow it.
100%.
So last thing here on appraisal, we'll get off the subject, but I am in contract on a house right now where the listing agent told me what the house appraised for like a month ago.
This is a crazy story.
We're not going to get into all the details right now, but he said, hey, this house appraised for $405,000 last month, and they're asking $480,000. And they were very adamant about not looking at offers under $480,000. I'm thinking to myself, well, $405,000, you know, to $408,000, it's a $75,000 swing. But there's no language in there that if the appraisal came in low, you know. So I was like, hey, we'll give them $480,000. We'll, you know, let's get our foot in the door. We wrote them $480,000. And guess what? That appraisal's coming back $75,000 short. And we were the only offer on the table. And that seller has no, you know, no other choice but to come down and get this deal done. So that was a big fudge on their part.
We really do have to talk negotiations on a separate episode. In the meantime, you guys need some education on your negotiations, feel free to give us a call. The next step, stay in consistent communication with the lender. We cannot stress this enough. Your lender should be reaching out to you as well. But man, when that lender calls, call them back. When they email you, email them back. When they ask for a document, give them that document. I don't care if they've asked for that document three times, give it to them anyway. And if you need to vent about it, call us and say, my darn lender's requesting the same thing three times and we're going to tell you, so what? Give it to them anyway.
Well, our lenders that we're going to recommend probably aren't going to do that to you. But true. Some of the more inexperienced ones, they're going to ask you for documents every day as they come in or as they're requested. But a good lender will know exactly what's going to be needed for the whole transaction and you'll try to get those from you up front.
Yeah. It does have some to do with the particular banks also, because there are some banks that don't allow their loan officers to keep the documentation in their computer files for more than 24 or 48 hours. And so they ask you for a document and they give it to the loan processor. And then, you know, 5 days later, the underwriter's requesting it. And so they have to request it from you again. But anyway, I don't want to go down that path.
Tip of the day, get fully underwritten. Solves all your problems.
Yes, absolutely. And the other thing,
keep saying it.
I'll just be very transparent with you. It doesn't matter if it's annoying to you or not. You still got to do it. All right. So you're going to stay in consistent communication with the lender. And then you've negotiated your repairs. You could have also negotiated a credit. What's that?
Yeah. So if you're in a situation where maybe the seller needs to get out of the house as soon as possible and they're like, hey, instead of doing these repairs for you and coordinating that, we're just going to give you $15,000, buyer, you can go ahead and do it yourself. And in that case, you write up an addendum that says seller is going to credit the buyer $15,000. And then you take that addendum and it needs to go straight to your lender and it needs to go straight to the title company.
That's right. I think that's something that we've seen in the past where that's the one way to get that escrow company really upset with you or your lender really upset with you is that you don't provide them with the price change or a credit change because they have to do their stuff on their end. And again, this absolutely should be the responsibility of your real estate agent, but everybody's human. And it's good to have everybody looking out after one another. So you look out after your agent. If you're working with us, though, we'll just look out after ourselves. We're good.
We got you covered.
All right. So let's just assume that you negotiated all your repairs. And then we get to towards the end, we get to the final walkthrough stage. This is going to happen about five days prior before. To the close of escrow. This is going to be your opportunity as a buyer to go through and one, make sure that the home is in significantly same condition or substantially in the same condition, I guess is the right verbiage for that. Substantially in the same condition as it was when you entered into escrow. This is also going to be your opportunity to confirm that all of the repairs that were agreed upon were done. They were done in a workmanlike manner and they were done with like materials. You want to make sure that that fabulous stainless steel dishwasher wasn't replaced with some used white 1970s dishwasher, although that probably worked better anyway. So final walkthrough, pretty quick, 5-10 minutes usually. And regarding those repairs, there's going to be a lot of stuff that you're not going to be able to verify on your own, right? Like if there's roof repairs, like you're not climbing on the roof to check it out. So you'll be getting invoices from these particular tradespeople that did the work that shows that the work was done, what the work was, and how much was paid for it. Hopefully any warranties that come along with it. And then we get to the stage where you might want to bring an ice pack. What's that?
That's going to be signing your loan documents and your closing documents. And if you're a buyer, you are going to have to sign like 200 pages. So stretch out your wrist, get your hand warmed up, knock out your signatures, and bring an ice pack because your hand is going to be sore.
And practice. because the funniest thing here is that if you bring in an ID with a middle name or a middle initial, or if your lender put your, this is the one that happens. The lender puts your middle name, your middle initial or your middle name in your loan docs. It's usually your middle initial. How many of us write our name with our middle initial? It's so like we're sitting there, these folks are having to write their name like 200 times. And the middle initial is the one thing that throws them off the most. So I've got a trick for you. The trick is sign your name normal, but just keep a little extra space between your first and your last name. And then you go back and you write your initial last. I don't know why it works better, but it works better. Write your first name, last name, and then your middle initial. If you try to do your first name, middle initial, last, you're going to screw it up over and over again. I would also encourage you not to have a really long, crazy name like Lujewski, because that's going to make things pretty difficult for you.
Oh, you have no idea.
Yeah.
Well, I have a hyphenated last name and a long middle name. It's like 37 letters long.
And technically a signature only needs to be an X. So I was complimented on my signature last night when I was filling out disclosures with one of our sellers. And she said, "You have the coolest signature. I would never be able to duplicate it and I can't read it." And that's exactly what we want.
Just scribble it down.
I just scribble and it's done. So practice your signature and ahead of time, get used to being efficient with it because you're going to use it a lot. And, I guess that's it. So loan docs. And then what happens after you sign loan docs? Do you own the home?
Not yet.
Not yet.
You're going to wait probably 24, 48 hours. Documents have to get overnighted sometimes. Sometimes they can get emailed, whatever. And then your deed has to get recorded at the courthouse. And once that's recorded, that's when officially you are a homeowner.
And you'll get the call from one of us, from your real estate agent. Congratulations, you're an owner. Meet me at the house and I'll give you your keys.
You've made it to the finish line.
So you think, but there's more because once you're in, you got to like get all your cable and all that stuff in play. So I would, I think we found that oftentimes your cable and your phone is not an automatic, immediate
transfer.
Mm-hmm. So you may want to call those companies a week or so in advance and just prepare them that you're going to be starting service at a particular residence so you can get on their schedules because you don't want to be without television for a whole week.
Yeah. And when you move in, you're always going to have questions about the house. Hey, Jeremy, how do my automatic sprinklers work? Hey, Jeremy, when's my trash day? Like you're going to have all these questions, right? It's a new neighborhood to you. We'll help you with that.
Why does it always have to be, hey, Jeremy? How come it's never, hey, Andrew? But he's right. He's right. Like your real estate agent just doesn't go away once they receive their check. Mm-hmm. Maybe some do. But yeah, it's not about, you know, receiving the check and walking away. We're along with you on this ride long term. So as you have questions, if there's things that you weren't aware of after you move in, give your agent a call. They also generally are going to have some level of access to the seller. You might even transfer or exchange information with the seller in advance, that kind of stuff. So, but other than that, enjoy your home and congratulations. You made it to the finish line.
Yeah. And actually I'm going to capitalize on what you said right there at the end. Some agents might not like it. They like to keep the buyer and seller completely separate, no communication, right? But sometimes I love it when we represent a buyer and they can meet the seller and the seller can walk them through the house and show them all the nuances and how things work or, oh, check this out. Sometimes that's a really great feeling. And sometimes, most of the time, the homeowner can explain the nuances of their own home better than we can, right? We didn't live there.
All the time. Yeah, absolutely. Well, that wraps it up for today. Appreciate you guys hanging out. I know some of that might've been a little bit long, and it's a stressful process, so it's not super, super sexy and super fun. But again, we know you're going to have questions. If you're a buyer, I don't care if you're in our area, Sacramento, Solano, Yolo County, or you're any area, we're always willing to accept your questions. Just give us an email at podcast@higginshomesearch.com, podcast@higginshomesearch.com. Andrew or myself promise to reply to your email with an answer, and we may even answer the question on the show. So we're out.
We're out of here.
Check you on the next one.